From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
I personally believe that a woman must have the right to decide what goes on in her own body, that a woman should have the right to decide her health care. I also believe that no woman should be forced to make a different decision than another woman would make purely based on her income.
It's not that hard to get on the ballot to be governor when you've got this kind of groundswell of opposition that I believe is going to be mounting here in the next few days.
The views on these issues are deeply held, strongly felt. And I've tried to make a decision that I believe is best.
That's Governor Bruce Rauner. He decided to sign a law allowing public funding of abortions through Medicaid and state employee health insurance. We also heard in there from State Representative and the Republican floor leader in the House, Peter Breen. He indicated many in the GOP see this as a betrayal and that a primary challenge to Governor Rauner could happen. Plenty to talk about regarding the fallout of the signing of this bill on State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford and joined in studio this week by Kent Redfield. He's a professor emeritus at the University of Illinois Springfield. Kent, thanks for being with us again.
Good to be here.
Also making her first appearance on the show with us, Illinois Public Radio reporter Daisy Contreras. Daisy, good to have you along.
Thank you.
And joining us from Chicago, political correspondent and good friend of our station, Amanda Vinicky. She's now with public TV station WTTW and the show Chicago Tonight. And Amanda, once again, thanks for being with us.
But of course, my pleasure.
Daisy, I'll start with you on this. Before we get into politics on this and what the fallout could be, explain what this law would do.
Yeah, so, you know, after months of speculation, Governor Rauner finally signed the abortion legislation into law. And what it will do, it will allow taxpayer funding for abortions and as well as remove trigger language that would make abortions illegal if Roe v. Wade is overturned at the federal level. So now in April, the governor stated intentions that he would veto the bill, which riled up pro-choice advocates. And Governor Rauner ran as a pro-choice candidate, and those pro-choice advocates were sure to remind him of that every chance they could.
Amanda, you were there for the governor's signing and their announcement of this, at least. And it sounded as though he had a tough time with this decision. He spoke rather softly, very measured in his speech. What was your takeaway from it?
Yeah, it was certainly a very different tone. Typically at bill signings, he's more jovial, particularly when surrounded by advocates, which he was. There were a lot of women. Corinne Wood, a familiar name to those who follow Illinois politics, former lieutenant governor, was one of them who spoke at its event. But it was not a bill signing ceremony. You know, typically he gives away pens and, again, is happy. You're there for supporters, with supporters. But that was very much not the case. If you don't know what to make of that tone, we tried asking about it, and the governor continued to get back to just the serious nature of the discussion, saying that he does understand and knows that there are irrefutable moral and religious aspects that need to be considered. But I don't know if that was why he took such a serious and almost morose tone, or if it was that he knew what he was stepping into of the political consequences of a decision like this.
Well, we heard from those folks who were upset by this, and that included Peter Breen at the start of the show there, mentioning that the governor might have some type of primary challenge from somebody on the right. And what are we hearing about that? Are we hearing any names that are really floating that could potentially challenge Governor Rauner?
The only name that is out there thus far really is Sam McCann, the state senator, who, of course, has had public feuds with Governor Rauner following his vote on a measure that unions saw as detrimental to them, and Rauner really had wanted passed, and instead McCann kind of broke ranks and was the first one to do so in a pretty spectacular fashion publicly and to say no and stick with Democrats on that one instead. And so McCann is the only name that is out there. He, of course, has, I think, some issues, though, when it comes to ethics measures or campaign spending that perhaps Professor Redfield can speak to from his own account. But that's not to say that that's the only person. We tried asking Representative Breen multiple times, you know, who are you going to get and who could go up against Governor Bruce Rauner's money, given that Rauner has become the primary funder, really, of the Illinois Republican Party and races such as Breen's own.
Kent Redfield?
Well, and, you know, I think, yes, you can put somebody on the ballot. I don't think that you're going to beat an incumbent governor in a Republican primary because that's certainly not, you know, abortion is an issue. It's not the only issue. The real danger from a primary is that if you heard these voices yesterday, you know, Senator McSweeney was talking about a failed governor. Breen was talking about an inability to competently administer the state and stand up to Madigan. And so, you know, a primary opponent to the governor is going to get a lot of media attention. And if you're going to hear a lot about not just the abortion, but you're going to hear about the governor can't deliver, the governor's incompetent. And that's, you know, that's the narrative the Democrats want to carry on into the primary, is that, you know, whatever you like about what Governor Rauner said before he got elected, you know, he can't deliver. He's a failure and he's made things worse. And so the real damage from the primary is that negative narrative. And then it adds to, you know, what it could really be an intensity gap. It's not that people won't show up and vote for Rauner in the general election. It's just they're not going to be, particularly in his right, the base, the social conservatives, they're not enthusiastic. They're not going to go bring their friends. And so, you know, a primary would have a lot of negative impacts. This is going to have negative impacts on his base in terms of enthusiasm to begin with, but a primary would just really intensify that because whoever's running against him is going to get a lot of free media coverage. They don't, you know, they don't need to run a lot of ads because it's going to be point counterpoint with the governor.
And Daisy, the governor, you know, going back to when he ran the first time, and he pointed this out in his comments on Thursday of this week, talking about this bill. He says he's always been pro-choice.
Yeah, he said he wasn't walking away from his initial remarks on where he stood personally. And ultimately, according to him, his decision to sign this measure boiled down to giving women access to abortions regardless of their income, and that him and his, you know, his wife were always going to stand behind that.
The issue with this, and this brings up something else that could damage the governor in a primary, is that there is, and damages him, frankly, from a governmental standpoint from here on out, although it's already perhaps been a drag already, is that he has now is perceived as a liar, that there is a trust issue. While the governor said, I have always been pro-choice and am never going to change my mind, he in fact apparently did, because he stated to Republican legislators and his administration issued a statement, and then the governor went on programs. I know during an interview it came up with me talking about his intention to veto the measure, this abortion bill, House Bill 40, that we're talking about. So that is not to say that that is a strict, you know, question of abortion rights in the yes or no. It gets more complicated than that. And in fact, when you talk to Representative Breen, for example, he said, I could have maybe accepted an amendatory veto where this so-called trigger language, keep that, but we don't want taxpayer funding of what he phrases elective abortions, talking about that as a major change and, frankly, a major expense for the state. So I think that's where you listen to the governor when he had his press conference and was asked about, what about this vacillating? He said that when he talked about vetoing the measure, that it was really an attempt at compromise in some way. He said continually that he tried to reach a middle ground, but neither side wanted that or would go along with it. Mind you, however, that is not what he said apparently to Republican legislators behind closed doors in conversations with the Cardinal Supich, and nor with conversations and comments to members of the media and speaking to the public.
And Daisy, this is a big step. I mean, this is something that advocates had wanted to see for a long time, and that is to get public funding of abortions through things like Medicaid. That was something the state, despite being considered more of a moderate state, had never taken that step before.
Right. I mean, advocates and sponsors have said that this has been brought up years before actually getting to this point. And, you know, even the pro-life advocates, they were, you know, from talking to them, they were sure that the governor would veto this bill from what they had heard from the governor. So this is a surprise for a lot of them.
And Kent, he said he wanted to find common ground, you know, in both sides. I mean, this is one of those issues. It's very hard to do that.
Yeah. No, you had two separate issues that if they would have been divided, I don't think the governor would have had any trouble or any qualms about signing language that removed this trigger mechanism if Roe were to be overridden. And quite frankly, the Supreme Court ever got to the point of overriding Roe, they would make all the states start over just like they did back in the sometime in the 60s when they essentially outlawed the way we were administering the death penalty. And they said, you know, every state has to start over. So the way the Democrats crafted it to combine these two issues put him in a box. When he was vacillating or making promises about what he would do to Republicans, this was at a time when he was trying to hold on to the House Republican caucus in terms of getting them to not back down on budgets and taxes and things. And so, you know, and obviously some of them, he lost enough of them that the Democrats overrode his vetoes on the budget and on taxes. But now he's at war with a significant part of his base of the Republican Party. And you know, we're seeing at the national level how well that works out when you've got, the chief executive at war with, part of his party. And so, you know, Trump is fighting with, big segments of the Republican Party. Now, Rauner may very well be fighting with, a segment of his base. And the trust issue here, as everybody is saying, I mean, that's huge in terms of getting things done in the legislature, and it plays into the narrative of, you know, you may like his ideas, but you can't trust him, he can't deliver, you know, and all of that, is what the Democrats are going to want to talk about in terms of why, Rauner shouldn't be reelected.
But, Ken, we've seen Jim Thompson, we've seen Jim Edgar, they were both, you know, considered pro-choice Republicans, and they were able to win statewide. And certainly Jim Edgar, I remember, had, primary opposition. It didn't hurt his ability to win.
Well, it is a factor. Enthusiasm gap, whether people come out. And frankly, the Republican Party, has changed. If you look at the whole breadth of this, the leader personal PAC, Terry Cosgrove, sometime, mentioned that, 10 years ago, there used to be two dozen members of the General Assembly that were moderate pro-choice Republicans. There are no pro-choice Republicans serving in the Illinois General Assembly. Peter Breen defeated in a Republican primary State Representative Fios, who was, had voted for gay marriage and was a pro-choice candidate. And the old Republican Party was much more pragmatic. I mean, it's become much more ideological, and it's well-funded. Richard Euland is the big backer of Dan Proft. Griffin and Rauner both gave money to Dan Proft and Liberty Principles. But, Euland had just put $2 million more in Liberty Principles. And that PAC is going to be out there in the primary pushing candidates about their vision of the Republican Party that is apparently quite different from, the governor's vision of much more pragmatic, economic, focusing on economic issues kind of Republicans.
Well, and Sean, can I just interject here that what Professor Redfield was talking about there in terms of the grouping of the quote-unquote trigger language with the coverage of abortions on state employees' health insurance and Medicaid, that was, frankly, a genius political move by Democrats. And let's keep in mind, that was very much by design. You don't have Democrats saying that, of course, very often. And this is a major victory for abortion rights advocates who believe that this is imperative, particularly to low-income women and to state workers, that they should have this choice, as the governor talked about. But really, you had Democrats hold super majorities in the General Assembly and had a Democratic governor. It's not like this had to come up just now. Maybe the trigger language, because people talk about the changeover with President Trump in office and changeover of the makeup of the U.S. Supreme Court. But there's nothing that prevented this from, you know, rising previously. This was designed to really put Bruce Rauner in a corner. You had protests continually with people may know the Margaret Atwood novel or now the TV show Handmaid's Tale. Women dressed in the handmade red caped costumes in front of the Thompson Center, downtown Chicago, continually protesting. J.B. Pritzker, the, of course, very well-funded Democratic candidate for governor, running ads about this very issue. So Democrats, in a sense, won either way. Had Governor Rauner vetoed this, they were going to use it to try and break off any moderates who Rauner had perhaps, frankly, not already lost through the budget battle, and then by instead signing it into law, angering that conservative base and doing all the things that Kent has been talking about. So it was a very political move, as well as, of course, obviously a policy one.
And Daisy, one thing that kind of surprised, I think, several of us was the fact that this bill, which had been held on to for months since it passed the legislature, and they used a parliamentary maneuver to not send it to the governor, and then they send it to him finally on Monday. He has 60 days to act on that. He could have waited. I mean, certainly he could be pretty much at the point of petition filing. He could avoid a primary, most likely, if he'd have waited on this. He acts rather quickly. That seemed to be a surprise, I think. I think it caught everybody off guard.
I think that's what it was. Asking advocates as to why now, why did you send the bill at this point when you could have held on to it a little longer? And they said, well, the governor in the past, he stated that, you know, first we have to deal with this budget issue, and then we'll have to deal with education funding, and then maybe we can look at the abortion legislation. So they felt that this was the perfect time for him to get that that bill on his desk. And like you said, it was a surprise for a lot of people. They weren't expecting him to act so fast on this.
Did he talk about that,
Amanda? I think that everybody didn't expect that, because the governor had an event on that morning, and on Thursday morning was before the Chamber of Commerce and was talking about this major decision regarding the U.S. Supreme Court taking up a case stemming from Illinois having to do with unions. He's talking about that, talked about a bunch of things, and it was at the end of the kind of Q&A period afterward with reporters that the governor had, that his press team said, watch your inboxes. We're going to have something. During the Q&A, reporters had asked, did you make a decision yet about House Bill 40? And they said, we will this afternoon. So it was not on his initial public schedule. Whether that was because of whatever pressure he was getting, whether it was to try and stave off those ads from Pritzker, whether it was that there was a Planned Parenthood executive, Cecilia Richards, that I believe was in town, although she was not at the press conference. Who knows what made him do it that day, but it was certainly very sudden and, I think, surprising to legislators. I believe he'd even had a meeting initially set up with some of the anti-abortion legislators for Friday that had to be moved, apparently now, because he was going to take this action.
Yeah, and, I think in politics, if you've got bad news, if something, you're going to get hammered for something, there certainly is a school of opinion that says, the sooner you get it out there, the better. Get it out there, get it all out there, and then, and so certainly if they would have held the bill, he's got 60 days to deal with it. So, they could have held it longer. He still could have taken 60 days and got to Thanksgiving to sign it. And so, part of the decision may have been, rather than deal with drip, drip, drip of all of these stories, then we're going to sign it. We'll take the hit. Yeah, there are going to be a lot of inside Republican politics about how we react to this, but overall, it's better to get it out there and get done. I mean, there's an old phrase that says better a horrible ending than horrors without end. And I think he was in a, you know, he was in a bad situation. And so I think they decided just, you know, let's deal with it and see if we can move on.
And before,
but had he waited, there wouldn't have been time for a challenger to truly mobilize.
Right.
And by doing it so early, there certainly is time for another candidate to get signatures and for the conservative wing of the GOP to truly mobilize.
Sure. And Kent, before we move on another topic, the last word on this, basically, we've talked about how this could hurt him politically. Can it help him too? Will there be moderates and people who are more abortion rights activists who might say, you know, I'm going to give this guy another look?
Well, you don't have as much enthusiasm among pro-choice people. You know, they would have been out there storming the barricades if he would have vetoed it, and he certainly would have gotten, you know, wouldn't have gotten, you know, pro-choice would have endorsed whoever the Democratic candidate is. They may still do that. I mean, you don't, you know, because there are a whole bunch of trust issues and there are all the issues that involve what happened with the budget. But I think there's clearly a political calculation that you're not, you know, being a pro-life, you know, taking a pro-life position is much more, causes much more damage in the general than any kind of damage he's going to have in the primary. And so, you know, we'll see. I don't think this was going to be his biggest problem. It, you know, it takes away, lessens one of the problems he was going to have to deal with. But, you know, so there's an upside among groups, but, you know, that are the pro-choice groups, but they don't have a lot of trust and faith in him to begin with. And so it's going to be, I think, pretty easy for a Democrat to talk to them and say, you know, you can, the governor and I are saying the same thing, and you can really believe me.
Amanda, let's talk about another issue the governor has been heavily involved with, and that is this push, this lawsuit that has been out there to do away with the public employee unions, the mandatory fees or union dues that are given to them from people that are in the bargaining unit. There's some people who say, you know, employees should have the choice of whether or not they want to give to the unions. Now the U.S. Supreme Court is going to take that issue up. What's at stake with this?
What's at stake is really unions see it as the future of public sector labor and also, frankly, of politics going forward and where you have major allegiances, alliances, and funding. The issue isn't so much quote unquote dues because you don't have to become a member of the union. It is a fee, however, that is required to be paid to unions for the collective bargaining work that they do, for the negotiating, let's say, on wages or benefits. That is what the governor and the individual, Mark Janis, he works for the Department of Healthcare and Family Services, says is a violation of First Amendment, that shouldn't be forced to pay this if he doesn't want to be a member of a union. Unions say, but wait, we're doing this work for you. This has long been part of precedent since going back to 1977, and that without having people required to pay these fees, you could see unions, just people saying, hey, if I don't have to pay, my checkbook is tight, I don't have money for that, not join the union. Then union membership drops, they lose negotiating power, but also then, of course, they don't have the money and the masses to help get their political victors elected. And more often than not, of course, that is Democrat. So it's also a very long game. I should add that Illinois now will be in the forefront, but there had previously been a similar case that rose out of California. When it came up last year, however, before a ruling was issued, Antonin Scalia passed away. So the Supreme Court bench was down one justice. That is why the governor, prior to sounding so morose and stern when in the announcement about House Bill 40 that morning, had sounded almost gleeful about the Supreme Court taking up this case, because that is something he will be able to sell to Republicans come election time, and has very much wanted. He tried to be part of that case himself, or at least in behalf of the state government, Illinois no longer is a party to the suit, but nonetheless brings a lot of attention. And of course, now you have Neil Gorsuch on the court, so the thought is that he would be the tiebreaker.
Now, Kent, you follow campaign finance, and certainly public employee unions play a role in campaign finance. This is a game changer for them, like they're concerned about?
Well, they're concerned about how it affects their membership, directly in terms of whether people join or don't join. And because if you're a member, you can build relationships, you can send mailings. Now, the actual money that goes into a political action committee is a separate contribution that members make. It's outside their union dues. You know, they have to, they get a mailing from the union, they write a check to the union. And that's what goes into the political action committee for AFSCME or for a teacher's union or what have you. And so, they wouldn't, this doesn't stop. This doesn't reduce the amount of money that's going into the political action committees directly. What it does, the potential there is to, again, you lose membership, you lose the ability to communicate with them. Now, union membership went down dramatically in Wisconsin after they rewrote the collective bargaining laws. One of the things was fair share, but they also took away the right of the unions to bargain over wages, health care. I mean, so lots of things came out of that were and that was resulted in those changes resulted in the dramatic drop in the number of union members, in addition to the fair share. I mean, the fair share is automatic, and you get billed for it whether you join the union or not. We don't know, and so it's hard to speculate exactly what this will do to political action committees, to total membership. When the governor initiated taking away fair share by executive action, it actually increased the number of people that were members of the unions, people going from fair share and joining the union. But so it's not good news. It's part of a long-term assault on collective bargaining. This is distinguished from cases involving private sector unions, but the rationale, which is that, well, you're not paying money for a PAC, but if you give money to the union for their administration, that allows them to lobby. That makes them a stronger organization. They can raise money. And so, that kind of logic it's more of a stretch to apply that to private sector unions. But if Janice is successful, then I'm pretty sure the groups that have been working on this case are going to go find some litigants to test whether they can extend it to private sector unions.
Time now for our notes from the field. Daisy, let's start with you.
Yeah, so there's this no salary history legislation that was vetoed by the governor earlier this year. Advocates are bringing it back to the floor for veto session, and now they're worried that the Republicans that voted for it are not going to show that support again, because from what I hear, Republican legislators really believe that the governor would sign this measure. So now that's up in the air if these Republicans' votes will be available during veto session.
Amanda?
Let's see, you had a pair of Republican legislators introduce a plan for higher education, and one of the interesting components of their idea would be a standard application for all Illinois public universities. I'll add here, if we do have time quickly, also that effort to lure Amazon to Illinois continues, particularly to Chicago. You had a committee that is honorary co-chaired by Governor Rauner as well as Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel. And then there are some 600 individuals on this committee.
That will do it for today. Members of our broadcast include Kent Redfield, Daisy Contreras, and Amanda Vinicky. And you can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org. The production assistance for State Week provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.